All right, so today we're going to be looking at Blorrie v. Falstaff Brewing Corp. This case is really all about best efforts clauses. You know the kind that make lawyers nervous? Imagine like selling your company and the buyer promises to use their best efforts to really make it thrive. You know, sounds pretty good, right? But what if their best just isn't like good enough? That's what this case is all about. You know, that's the question at the heart of it.
And what's interesting is that it really brings out the tension between a company's contractual duties and their own business interests, because sometimes, you know, those things clash.
They can be totally at odds.
Exactly. And that's when, you know, the legal stuff
Yeah,
begins.
that's when you end up in court. So this case takes us back to 1972. Falstaff Brewing Corporation, big name in the beer industry, buys Ballantine's trademarks, distribution networks, all, you know, the whole shebang for $4 million. Plus, they agree to pay royalties on future sales of Ballantine beer, like 50 cents a barrel for the next 6 years. Sounds pretty straightforward, but here's where it gets tricky. The contract includes a best efforts clause. So Falstaff was legally obligated to make reasonable efforts to keep those Ballantine sales strong. I mean, you'd think after spending all that money,
$4 million.
$4 million exactly, that they would want to see it succeed.
Right, you would think. But the court found that what they actually did didn't match up with what they'd promised. For example, they closed down a bunch of those key distribution centers for Ballantine, and that limited access to the smaller venues where Ballantine was really popular. And it wasn't just about like saving money, it was strategic. You know, they were limiting the brand's reach.
So it's almost like even if a business decision seems kind of neutral, it could be seen as breaching that best efforts idea if it ends up really hurting the brand, right? Like death by a thousand cuts.
Exactly. And it doesn't stop there. Like, they picked distributors who were already dealing with all these competing brands, and they'd often prioritize, you know, Falstaff's own products.
Oh, so you're trying to sell a product when your own distributor is pushing a competitor.
That's right.
What? That's wild.
Yeah, it's almost like they were setting them up to fail.
So they were pushing their own products, limiting Ballantine's distribution. Did they even try to like grow the brand at all?
Well, get this. They actually rejected a partnership with Guinness Harp,
What?
which would have been huge for Ballantine, you know, especially in New York City.
Wow.
Missed opportunity for sure. And then they went even further and like incentivized their sales teams to focus on Falstaff products over Ballantine.
So like directly telling them, hey, push our stuff, not theirs.
Pretty much.
What was their defense? Like, surely they knew this wouldn't hold up in court, right?
Well, their argument was that they weren't obligated to run Ballantine at a loss, you know, just to meet some vague best efforts clause. But the court clarified and said, look, a company's not expected to go bankrupt, but they do have to explore, you know, reasonable, low-cost options to try and fix declining sales. And Falstaff just didn't prove they'd done that.
Okay, so they didn't meet that burden of proof,
Exactly.
which is a big point for anyone, you know, dealing with these clauses.
Right. You can't just say you tried your best. You have to show it.
Did the court like look at that thing where they got rid of the sales goals for Ballantine? Like, did that play into it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was a major factor. By taking away those targets, it was like they were saying, we're not really committed to making Ballantine successful. And then, you know, their whole company policy of prioritizing profit over volume just reinforced that idea, you know, like they weren't acting in good faith.
Okay, so by this point, it's pretty clear that Falstaff was making some questionable choices. But did the court actually say that these decisions added up to a breach of the best efforts clause?
They did. The court ruled that, you know, Falstaff's actions were more than just bad business judgment. They were a sign that they weren't acting in good faith to stick to their end of the deal. It wasn't just a few mistakes, it was a whole pattern of decisions that directly hurt Ballantine's sales.
So this is a big deal for our listeners who are, you know, in the legal world. This case shows that best efforts isn't just some vague thing you throw into a contract. It requires real actions to show you're committed to the agreement.
Absolutely. It sets a really important precedent. And there's actually another layer to this case we need to talk about, the liquidated damages clause. This was a part of the contract that would have meant a whole other set of penalties if Falstaff had substantially discontinued distributing Ballantine beer.
Welcome back. We're digging into Blorrie v. Falstaff Brewing Corp. And we were just talking about this liquidated damages clause. It could have really changed things in this case. Yeah, totally. Blorrie, the trustee of Ballantyne, was arguing that what Falstaff was doing was basically a substantial discontinuation of the distribution. So that could have meant those liquidated damages would kick
in. It would have been a huge financial hit for Falstaff. But this is where, you know, the whole idea of really precise contract drafting comes in. The court said that the liquidated damages clause didn't apply because, technically, Falstaff had expanded the distributor network across the country, even though they were messing with Ballantyne's success within that network.
So even though Ballantyne's sales were tanking, they weren't actually breaking that specific part of the contract.
Yeah.
It's like, technically, they're in the right, but ethically.
Right.
Well, that's not really our call, is it?
Right, right.
But it definitely shows how important it is to be super clear when you're writing contracts. Like, every word matters.
Absolutely. Ballantyne's sales were going down because of bad promotion and because they were getting less attention within the distribution network. It wasn't like they completely stopped distributing the beer, which is what the contract actually said.
Mm.
It's a big lesson for lawyers or anyone who deals with contracts.
Yeah.
Gotta sweat the details, you know. Define everything carefully and think about those loopholes, those little things that people could try to exploit.
So Blur v. Falstaff really had a lasting impact, right? It wasn't just about settling things between these two companies. It set a standard for how courts look at best efforts clauses, even today.
Totally. It's been cited in tons of cases and decisions. One of the biggest things it highlighted was this idea of good faith. The court said that best efforts isn't just about doing something. It's about really trying to make the agreement work, showing that you're committed to it.
So it's not enough to just, you know, go through the motions or do the bare minimum just to avoid a lawsuit.
Yeah.
It's about genuinely working towards what the contract was supposed to achieve, like what everyone reasonably expected when they signed it.
Exactly. You have to make decisions that help the acquired brand succeed, you know, within reasonable business limits, of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But this brings up a tricky question. How do you prove good faith? It's kind of subjective, right? What seems reasonable to one person might not be enough for someone else.
Yeah, it does feel kind of slippery, legally speaking. What advice would you give to lawyers who are dealing with these best efforts clauses? How can they protect themselves and their clients?
Documentation is key, for sure. If you're the one who's supposed to be using best efforts, you need to keep a record of everything you've done, the decisions you've made, and most importantly, why you made those choices. It's not just about covering yourself if there's a lawsuit. It's about being transparent and accountable within your own company.
So Blur v. Falstaff is like a practical guide for businesses, telling them to be upfront and open about how they're handling these best efforts obligations.
Yeah, I think so.
But the case also recognized that best efforts doesn't mean destroying your own business. Like, the court acknowledged that Falstaff didn't have to keep running Ballantyne at a loss.
That's right. There are limits to best efforts. It's not like a blank check where you have to spend all your money or go bankrupt. But, and this is really important, the court also said that Falstaff had to show that there weren't other things they could have done, maybe less costly things, to help Ballantyne.
So it's this balancing act, right? You gotta make a real effort without sinking your own ship.
It seems like the court was trying to find that sweet spot between what the contract says and what's realistic for the business.
Yeah, that's exactly why Blur v. Falstaff keeps getting used in cases where people are arguing about best efforts. It gives us a framework to look at what actions were taken, what other options were considered, and the overall financial situation.
So this case isn't just some old beer story. It's about setting a reasonable standard for how we judge best efforts in all kinds of business deals.
Exactly. And it reminds us that the law is often trying to be fair and reasonable, not impose crazy expectations. The goal is to make sure the contract is honored while also understanding that running a business is complicated. Makes sense. So for anyone out there who's negotiating or writing contracts with these tricky best efforts clauses, what are the biggest takeaways?
Be clear. The more specific you are about what best efforts means, the less likely you'll end up in a mess like Blur v. Falstaff. Instead of using vague language, try to set concrete targets or benchmarks that show how you're going to measure performance.
So instead of just saying, try your best, you'd want the contract to say something like, increase sales by 10% each year or get the product into 50 new stores.
Exactly. And if you can't measure it with numbers, at least give some examples of what you expect.
Right. So everyone's on the same page from the beginning.
Right. You don't want to end up arguing about what best efforts actually means, you know?
Yeah. He said, she said, situations are never good. So we've talked about how important clear drafting is. But what if there is a disagreement? What should lawyers know about litigating a case that involves best efforts?
A big lesson from Bloor v. Falstaff is that the person who's accused of breaking the best efforts clause is usually the one who has to prove they didn't.
Oh, interesting.
And in this case, Falstaff had to show that they'd taken reasonable steps to support Ballantyne and that doing anything more would have cost them a fortune. They couldn't prove that, and that's why they lost.
So it's not enough to just do the right thing. You have to be able to prove you did it. Lawyers need to tell their clients to keep good records and create that paper trail, right?
Exactly. You got to be meticulous about that stuff. Every email, meeting notes, strategic plans, it could all be used to show that you were acting in good faith and sticking to the best efforts part of the agreement.
Okay, so this case is about beer, but it's really relevant for all kinds of business contracts. We've talked about the legal stuff, the strategies, the challenges of dealing with these best efforts clauses. But there's one more big piece we haven't gotten to yet. Calculating damages.
Yeah, that's a big one. What are the financial consequences of breaking a best efforts promise? How do you actually put a dollar amount on that?
All right, so we're back for the final part of our deep dive into Bloor v. Falstaff Brewing Corp. And we've really gone through a lot, you know, dissecting what Falstaff did wrong, exploring this whole idea of best efforts and good faith. But now let's talk about the bottom line. Like, how did the court actually decide what Falstaff had to pay for messing up?
Well, this is where things get kind of interesting. Remember, we talked about that liquidated damages clause,
right?
That part of the contract that could have really hit Falstaff hard financially.
Yeah.
Well, didn't apply because technically Falstaff didn't completely stop distributing the beer. So the court had to come up with another way to figure out the damages just based on them breaking that best efforts promise.
Which is tricky, right? Like, how do you put a price tag on not trying hard enough?
Yeah, there's no simple formula for that. So the court used what they called a comparative performance approach. Basically, they looked at how much Ballantyne's sales dropped while Falstaff was supposed to be using their best efforts, and then compared that to how similar beer brands were doing in the same time period.
So they were trying to see how much of the drop in sales was because of Falstaff's actions.
Right.
Like taking into account the overall beer market at the time.
Exactly. Like, let's say Ballantyne sales went down by 25%, but other similar brands only went down by 5%.
So the court would say that extra 20% drop was Falstaff's fault.
Right, because they weren't holding up their end of the best efforts deal. So Falstaff would then have to pay royalties on that 20%, basically the money Ballantyne would have made if Falstaff had actually done what they promised.
It's a pretty cool way to figure it out, huh? Like, they're trying to create a what-if scenario to see how Ballantyne could have done if Falstaff hadn't messed up. But it can't be perfect, right? There must be some problems with doing it that way.
Of course, it's not a flawless system. Some people argue that it relies too much on assumptions about how the market works and how well a brand would have done, things that are hard to prove for sure. It's not like looking at a contract and seeing a clear price, you know? There's some guesswork involved, for sure.
It does seem like a pretty complicated calculation. You'd need experts and a really good understanding of the beer market to make it work.
Yeah.
But in the end, the court decided this was the fairest way to figure out how much Ballantyne had lost.
Right. Yeah, and they did it without getting too speculative or trying to punish Falstaff, you know? It was about finding a solution that made sense given the contract and the situation.
So this whole case is like a masterclass in contract law, right?
Yeah.
We've seen how tricky these best efforts clauses can be, the importance of acting in good faith, that whole burden of proof thing, and the difficulties of figuring out damages. It shows us that even when we're dealing with kind of fuzzy concepts like best efforts, the law still has ways to deal with it when someone doesn't live up to their promises.
Right. It shows how flexible and nuanced the legal system can be. Contracts matter, and courts will try their best to make things right, even when it's hard to put an exact number on the damage that's been done.
Yeah, for sure. Bloor v. Falstaff is a great lesson for lawyers and business people alike. It tells us to be super careful when writing contracts, to keep good records, and to actually try to fulfill your obligations in a way that's both fair and makes good business sense.
It's a case that people still talk about in both the legal world and the business world. It reminds us that every contract is based on trust and a shared understanding of what's expected.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with something to think about. Would you rather have a contract that tells you exactly what you need to achieve, even if it's really tough? Or would you go with the best efforts clause? Even though it's kind of vague, there's no easy answer, but it's something to consider as you work on your own agreements. That's all for this deep dive into Bloor v. Falstaff Brewing Corp. Keep exploring, keep learning, and keep those legal minds sharp.